The following episode of the Father More podcast features a man named Robert Hill. Robert Hill is my jiu-jitsu professor here in Glendale, California. I've known him for a really long time. I actually started doing jiu-jitsu when I was living in Austin, but I've known Robert since before I started doing jiu-jitsu. He was a member at my and my brother's CrossFit affiliate here in LA. And so I've known him for 10 years, 10 plus years at this point. And he has two kids who are being sort of raised in a really interesting situation because he is a divorcee. He has majority custody. So he keeps his kids Monday through Friday because he's able to have a lot more flexibility with his work since he owns his own business. He owns his own place of business. And so his kids kind of grow up with him, around him, and in this jiu-jitsu academy. And there's a lot of really interesting things about his past and his relationship with his parents and how his relationship with his now ex-wife sort of ended up where they're at and how they co-parent in that type of a unique world that I think was really interesting for me, not only as the host of a podcast, but also to get to know him a little bit better as well. So, you know, I've seen his kids grow up and I've sort of seen the way he interacts with them, which is very, very unique. It's very, very different than what you might expect. But there is a really interesting clarity to how he's doing things and why he's doing the way that the things he's doing and how he's raising his kids that I think you're going to find really fascinating. So enjoy and take care. All right. Yeah. What I was saying before, by the way, we are going to do that. What I was saying before was that, you know, like, oh, I'll just hold this like threateningly the entire time. And you're like, that's not going to help. That comes up in my mind on a regular basis of like, I don't think there has been a point in the entire time that we've known each other that you haven't really, truly, physically been able to murder me. Like on a whim.
And you'd be surprised though. I think a lot of that's in your head. I think that I use that to my advantage quite a bit.
So that is something that I think about, not in the sense of like instilling a sense of fear in myself, but almost in like, I'll know that I've done well in my like studying of jiu-jitsu when that is no longer, that's like a coin toss. It progresses, right? It goes from like, you know, 100% of the time to like a coin toss to like maybe in my favor every now and then to like, I can do this, you know? It's kind of strange to think about that.
You know what? It's a little bit of a double-edged sword too, though. Because what you're seeing is, and I was actually reading a book this morning. I was reading Breathe. It's still in my car. Breathe. I think it's Hicks and Gracie's autobiography or biography. I lost the education to remember which is which. I think autobiography means he wrote it himself.
Yes.
Which likely he did. Now, it's a great book. Don't get me wrong. He's got a lot of cool stuff in it. But he talks about his uncle, Grandmaster Carlos, about him being like... Or maybe Elio said it. Maybe Helio said it. Maybe his father said it. But it was something like he used jiu-jitsu to recover like his masculinity and things like that, and like how he could be a man because he was a scrawny guy. He was very weak, and like how he could be just like he could recapture his confidence as a man. Like I think that's pretty much how he puts it in the book there. And it's just kind of funny because like as you go through the ranks in jiu-jitsu, and I'm certainly going to try not to talk too much about jiu-jitsu. But,
I mean, it's fair to talk about it. It's a big part of our lives.
Yeah,
so. It's a huge part of my life. Yeah.
The problem is, especially today, and Christ, I could open up a can of worms, but people who have a black belt are an authority in the subject of and only of jiu-jitsu. But it's also like when celebrities get a talking point, like, listen, you're supposed to make people laugh. You're supposed to make people cry. You're supposed to go on screen and be awesome and pretend to be something. Like, go and fucking act. Your opinion shouldn't make any difference about what the political system is. So being a black belt, it accidentally gives you a platform to voice your own opinions. Mm-hmm. Also, we're not all of great character. So you gotta, like, remember that. A black belt is just... Like, yeah, I've put 16 years into jiu-jitsu. That means I know what I'm talking about in jiu-jitsu. The rest of my opinions are just they should relatively just be like anybody else, you know?
Yeah, I think.
But
there's,
nobody takes them that way.
No, because people assume. I think part of that could be a cultural thing here in the States specifically, because martial arts has been like, you know, through those it was like Chuck Norris, Bruce Lee, Steven Seagal, like they kind of colored what martial arts, which essentially at that point was all like called karate, but or called kung fu, but yeah. It was none of those things. They kind of, especially Bruce Lee, did like the whole martial arts as like a philosophy and not just a physical practice. And then kids are thrown into like karate schools because it's how you learn discipline. And then the assumption there, which is implicit and maybe not necessarily sold straight up as marketing, but it's implicit, is that if you do it long enough, then you have those things. Then you have a good philosophy on what it means to be human, and you have a good philosophy on how to apply discipline to your life and to other people's lives, and to like be a good example or authority or role model in some sense, where it's not necessarily the case. Like you could just put your entire life into being really good at physicality,
yes,
and not have those other things.
Absolutely. Well, you do actually get those other things. You do actually get like the discipline. You do get the character development. You do get a notion and sense of what's right and what's wrong, but you can't fix the, and you can't do anything about the foundation of all that stuff. So everybody has this human foundation of what your parents put into you. And this is actually probably a good start to the, yeah. into the podcast.
This is all going in there.
If you're all going in there.
Yeah, this is all going in there.
You have an early foundation of a sense of right and wrong. And most of the time, your parents have instilled it in you, or your life experiences as a child have put those into you. And then that's your base foundation. And then all of this, the martial arts aspect, piles on top of that, right? So you can have this sense of right and wrong. You can have this sense of inner strength and integrity and all this. You have all this wisdom. And for sure, martial arts will give it to you, especially jiu-jitsu will give it to you. But if this underlying foundation is rotten, then all of it's just kind of a show. And a lot of times in any authoritative situation, I go to the shining example is like the Bikram yoga thing, which can no longer be called Bikram, right? It's hot yoga, yeah.
Of who Bikram was. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, right? All of the cult underlying and all of that stuff just came crumbling down, you know? That guy had all of the wisdom, all of the charisma, all of the integrity, but the underlying character that was developed was soft or broken and ultimately corrupted everything from the bottom up. And that happens when people see you as an authority figure. It happens in anytime someone comes to you for knowledge, they immediately put you as a better person than themselves. And I think that's what helps people learn, maybe. So it puts you in a really uncomfortable position sometimes, because there's a lot of people who are in positions of power and deep down they're garbage.
Yeah.
You know,
or just on the surface are straight up garbage.
And yeah.
Just,
you
know, I think that presents a couple different issues, right? It presents like the problem of coming to terms with the idea that someone who may not be a good person has something of value to teach you.
Yeah.
And then also the other side of it, of being able to let go of the pedestal that you put someone on in order to absorb the things that might be positive and like segment those things in your mind of how you interact with other people. And yeah, I think that's a challenge for both directions. Like that's a challenge for the learner as well as the teacher.
Yeah.
But you know, I wonder, you know, you have obviously a ton of experience in jiu-jitsu. It's like your entire life at this point.
Mm-hmm. More than, yeah.
And you have two kids. Mm-hmm. How old are your kids now? 3 and 5? No.
No. Almost 4 and 7.
Four and seven. Okay.
November, my daughter will be 7. Margo will be 7 in November. And then Oliver will be 4 in December.
Okay.
Yeah. 7 and 4. Yeah.
And so you have this like lifetime of jiu-jitsu, which is like the thing about, I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand about jiu-jitsu is like they think of martial arts and they think of kids' martial arts, or they think of like what they picture as karate or whatever. Mm-hmm. A black belt in jiu-jitsu is brutally earned. I mean, it is earned over a segment of years, like an entire portion of your life. There were blood and sweat and pain and recovery and hurt and just like emotional problem. Like it is an earned thing. Like there is no way of, you can go on eBay and buy a black belt, but you get, you get realized very quickly, right?
Yeah. You have to back it up. I believe it was Henzo that said that the belt covers 2 inches of your ass and it's up to you to cover the rest.
That's wrong.
And it makes a lot of sense, because the black belt is just something that happens. You just keep showing up. And because really it represents what you've done through the act of learning the martial art. But for me, any of the belts that you earn, they represent that you overcame a lot of stuff that was trying to pull you out of what your passion could be. Jiu-Jitsu takes at least 5 to 6 years. Some people earn it a little bit quicker because they have competition accolades. And yeah, technically, for sure, they've earned it, and everybody goes through wonderful stages of their life and tragedies in their life at different paces. So I don't mind seeing people who get black belts in like 3 to 5 years because they've most likely been through a lot of stuff. When it comes to, I was just having this conversation with somebody up in Paso where I just took a little mini vacation for my own mental health. And, we're talking about promoting people. And one of the questions is like, what is the qualifications for a black belt? Qualification for a purple belt, keep showing up. Brown belt, fine, you keep showing up. But when you go to give someone a black belt, they're tied to you forever. That means their character, their skills, what they're going to do in the future is in a way tied to you. So now it's not just, I can give this guy a belt and if he quits, whatever. But if I give this guy a black belt and then, he has all of his lineage tied to me, he has all of his future tied to me, like, this is a big question. So the qualifications become very fuzzy at that point because they're all good at jiu-jitsu.
Sure.
But where are they going to be as a representation of what I want to portray jiu-jitsu as or what I want to put, I also have responsibility to the people that came before me.
Right.
All that blood, sweat, tears, and pain, and quit, and recovery, and encouragement. That's all sitting on this other person's shoulders, too. So it's like I have to make sure that I'm responsible for the people who came before me. So the qualifications get very fuzzy. It gets kind of difficult when it comes time to grant a black belt, whether they've earned it. Usually jiu-jitsu skill isn't even a question at that point.
Do you see the similarity of what you're describing along with the similarity of what you're talking about with granting a black belt or what does it take to be a black belt, but like with fatherhood?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just way, way easier to be a dad than it is to be a black belt.
No, not at all. It's so much easier to be a black belt than a father.
It's way easier to become a dad than it is to
become a black belt. Absolutely. You can accidentally make a kid.
Yes. Yes, many people have.
You can, like, oh shit. Yeah. You can accidentally make a kid. You can't accidentally become a black belt.
No.
But
do you see that similarity, that idea of like, not only are you tying yourself to this person forever, your lineage prior is being reflected through the future generations. They are saying their own behavior is also going to reflect you and their future generations. There's a lot, I feel like, that is like a through line between that relationship of...
Yeah, I see it not so... Maybe I'm looking at it from a more pessimistic point of view, but I do see it kind of as I want to say that you want to prune away the negative things that came before you. But now being a father today versus being a father even like 15, 20 years ago, I'd imagine is just drastically different, or maybe back in like the 80s and 90s. So I think that the whole family dynamic has changed a lot. I'm a single father. So I just have my kids Monday through Friday. I have like some 70-some-odd% custody. So Monday through Friday, I have my kids, and then their mom takes them to the weekends. And that's just the way things ended up. There's nothing, bad about that situation. But it presents me with more time with my kids than my father ever had with me, and more time with, more time than his father had with him. I think Jim Gaffigan, a comedian out there, he said, I have more pictures of my kids than my dad ever looked at me. and I think it's kind of true. I mean, right? Like,
it's totally true.
It used to be that your mom stayed home and she she did what she needed to do. She raised up the kids. She was stay at home, and then your dad went to work. And then some point in the 80s and 90s, that changed. And then, you know, even now with the pandemic, you know, moving along.
It's even crazier. Like work from home has turned into a thing, and there's no more separation of like work life, family life, personal life, relationships. Like all of it has been glommed into like one location.
Even school life, you know, I teach jiu-jitsu. I run the academy. I was a kindergarten teacher, and then I also ran daycare for my kid at the same time. And all of the negative things that you heard about, like, oh, you shouldn't let your kids watch TV. You reach a point, especially in the middle of the pandemic, where you're like, watching TV, kid, like, everybody sit down. Yeah, like, I can't do this.
There's a lot that you talked about here. I want to jump into a lot here. And I think at this point, you know, and I've done an intro. People who are watching or listening to this, I've done an intro introducing who you are, which is
fantastic.
Why we didn't go like over your, you know, your.
Well, Chris, I hope it didn't hype me up too much.
No. Yeah.
I will say this really quick.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny that when you posted it out there, like, hey, do you know any dads that are killing it?
Yeah.
And right away I was like, for sure, me. Yeah. Cause I'm as humble as you get. But I had to laugh at that. Because after having two kids and going through like all the things that I've gone through, I look at a brand new father and you're like, who's killing it out there? You know who the answer is? Fucking nobody. None of us are killing it. We're all just getting by. And you're going to discover that. You're going to discover that as your kid grows and as you become a father and grow as a father too, you're going to look at your parents and go, oh Christ, they didn't know what they were doing either. Like knows what they're doing.
You know, okay. So I've been thinking about this a lot as well recently, because you're not the only one that's mentioned that. And I think I may have just worded it improperly. Like what I'm really looking for is like people to have a conversation with and learn from.
Gotcha.
And that means successes and failures. My desire, like my first blush guess at it would be, I'd probably prefer to speak to somebody who's successful in like keeping their kids alive, raising kids that aren't assholes, and also living a life that includes something other than being a dad.
Gotcha.
And that's kind of what I mean by killing it, because I got a lot of people that were like, none of us are killing it, dude. You're like, you're narrowing the scope down way too much. You're never going to talk to anybody. But the other side of that, by the way, is that maybe, and again, I've been at this for all of 2.5 months, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But is it maybe that all dads have the same type of imposter syndrome?
Probably the most honest and sane ones do. I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch out there who are
convinced that they're killing it.
Like, I'm just fantastic.
That was also...
They're also probably not with their children most of the time.
Yeah, I was going to say that was also one of the
things... They
have
nannies and shit.
One of the positives that came out of me posting it that way is that I immediately knew who not to talk to.
Oh.
Because it was the people that were like, me, bro. I've got
I think that's
this.
What I said,
I've
though.
Been, I've been murdering this. No. I don't know. If, I can't... I
no, mine was a little more sarcastic, yeah.
But like... it's like it immediately shined a light on the people who are like too ego into like their thing.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are recommended by other people, those are the ones that I tried to really speak with the most. And so anyway,
sorry,
there's a lot that we went into here.
Yeah, go for it.
Your role as like dad is very different than the other dad roles that I've interviewed already. I've talked to a bunch of different people, from newborns to grown kids going off to college to, you know, just a whole slew of children under the age of like 5 or 6, like 4 kids on the age of 6. Ugh. Wild. But you're the first dad that I've spoken to that is divorced and has the kids Monday through Friday. So you have the majority of that
correct.
Time. How did that end up being the case, by the way? Because usually it's the opposite, right?
Yeah. Actually, it's really quite, let's see. When we split, when my ex-wife and I split, it wasn't pleasant. There was never any like abuse. There was never anything like super negative. And we share legal custody. You know, there's never any like major issues there. And I try not to speak negatively about her, about the kid's mom. It's just there was different focuses. I ended up with a really good career. that afforded me a lot of time. And so, in a way, like logistically, it just made sense for me to have the kids because it was easier for me to do my job. I work at night. I work until like 9 o'clock, but I work from 5 to 9. I own the building. No one can complain that my kids are there. And it just worked out logistics wise. She also, or the kid's mom also has particular career aspirations, and, you know, an idea of how she wants our children to live. And her only way to do that is to dive into her career. At least that's the going like explanation mm-hmm. of it. Now, the weird thing is the system is not rigged for me.
It doesn't seem like it would be.
It was hard. Because the kid's mom kind of wanted all that free time and kind of wanted a way to dive into her career much deeper. I don't look at that as a bad thing because I think she's looking towards the future. There are negative sides of it. She's missing a lot of her kids' early career, early life. And I'm a terrible mom. Fantastic father. Come on. But even the best father is still like, meh, as far as a mother's concerned.
Sure.
Like, I'm looking at my daughter's head and I'm like, I don't even know what shampoo to use. You know, like what, she's seven, she's coming up on 7 right now. Like if I don't do these first like 7-8 years correctly, I'm looking at a monster for 14. Like, I don't know what I'm going to get when this kid goes into things that I had, like the boy. Okay. I can deal with the boy, you know? It's like, you know, just don't take your penis out in public. Like put that away. Like, you know, just yeah. like whatever. That's it. Like as long
like
as
rule number one,
yeah. Like rule number one, that stays in your pants and don't talk. Like, I think the first day I dropped him off at school, I took him to preschool. I looked down at him and I just said, just don't swear. And he looked at me and I was like, all right, fine. And then the mom standing next to me was just like, that's it's just that like people just start laughing at that. Like I'm like, look, just don't swear and don't steal from people. And yeah, good luck, dude. You know, just like sent him in there and he did wonderful. You know, it just ended up that way. It's good for the kids. I guess like, it's not ideal. I would have liked to have had more 50-50 because it changes a lot in the way that I have to handle and deal with myself. So you end up with a lot of pressure. It puts an immense amount of pressure on relationships. I've been through, like right out of the marriage, I got into a really bad one. That was miserable and that left a whole bunch of scars that I'm dealing with. And then, you know, you look at trying to date at like 40 with 2 kids almost full time, and it's a strange situation to be in,
yeah,
for sure. And plus, like, you have to take into account like how is this gonna affect the kids, seeing me with somebody else, and yeah. like there's a whole lot going on that I never thought that I would have to deal with.
How do you, and maybe you don't, but how do you find a way of sort of like watering the plant of your own life? Like how do you like keep Robert an actual individual human being when you have 2 kids 70% of the time and the academy and, you know, like all these different things that are pulling you in different directions?
A lot of scotch. No,
I find myself yeah. at the bottom of a bottle.
I find myself at the bottom of a bottle. No, you know what? I don't hide any of it. I think that's just kind of how I am. My kids see me when I'm sad. They see me when I'm happy. And I thought a lot about how much of my kids should I expose to my personality. And the answer is all of it. Because we going back a little bit, like you talked about how, or we had spoken a little bit about how, like, you know, you want to have your lineage behind you and to see who this kid is in front of you. I kind of see parenting in a way today as pruning away not the negative experiences, but the negative lessons that I had as a kid. So you always want to make your kid a little bit better than you. Mm-hmm. You want to teach them the things that nobody taught you. Like, oh, I wish I had known this as a kid. You want to be the dad that you wanted. My father was fantastic, by the way, and I still have wonderful contact with him, and like, you know, but at the same time, there's also lessons that I never learned from him. Maybe he didn't know how to convey it. He was a much younger father than I was, but I do look back and I'm like, oh, you were figuring shit out at the same time. And now I go back and I talk to him, I'm like, Dad, what were you thinking during this part of your life? Because I had a, you know, I don't want to get off on a tangent too much, but my dad, I had a sister that she died at, I think, 6 months. So it was a combination of like pneumonia and SIDS. And I was so young that I never really processed that all that well. I remember my dad just took me to the park and said, like, hey, your sister's gone. You know, it was much different conversation than that. It was much handled much better. But, like, that's kind of it. And, you know, I was 10, 11. So now going back after having two kids that have grown and, like, gone through, you know, the first couple years of their life, I can sit down with my dad and go, hey, what was it like losing a child?
Yeah.
And that is, like, a really interesting topic. And he can tell me, okay, well, this is what your mother and I went through. This is how we handled it. And so you look at your kids and be like, okay, well, this is a lesson for loss, and I can teach you how to handle loss now. But he never told me that when I was 11.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he couldn't have. So as you look at your kids and you want to raise them up and you want to give them lessons, you want to teach them, like I said, like the lessons that you maybe weren't taught at that same age. And it's touchy.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they're not ready for it. Like, my dad never talked about their divorce. You know, now I have two kids, you know, coming up on seven, that, like, my son, he never remembers a time when I was with his mom. So in, you know, 6-8 years, there's going to be some questions. And so his mom and I broke and divorced, and she moved out, or I moved out, and then she moved out, like, we made boxes, or I made boxes, and I think she did too. Where at one point, I can sit down with my kids, you know, when they're teenagers, and say, listen, mom and dad had a failed relationship. Check out this box. You know, and I can go through, like, years of pictures and years of letters and, like, years of things where I can be like, oh, man, where'd that come from? Yeah, a little bit of emotion. And you can go through and, like, say, look, hey, mom and I actually had a good life for, you know, these years. The touchy part there is to make sure that the kids know, like, you have to edit that. Sorry about that.
No.
You're going to, but the kids like, hey, it's not your fault.
Yeah. That.
Sorry about that.
No, yeah, don't apologize. One of the things that I'm
so I guess I had a lot of scotch, you know, you bury some shit.
No, no, that's good. I think it's important. Part of this, like, podcast has been for me accepting that dads aren't Terminator. Like, they're not emotionless robots.
That is a change, I think, because if I look back at my father, who was a Marine, and yeah, he, like, never, there was never, like a, what did he say? He told me as a kid. He told me a lot of bad shit. But anyway, he told me, like, you know, he said, hey, guilt is something that you should just be able to sit down and fix and then move forward. But my personality, I'm looking back, I'm like, no, Dad, like, no, that's how you bury stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that was something that was handed on to him. So I go back to these lessons of, like, how you should handle yourself. And then the negative lessons you shouldn't hand on to your kids. So you should tell them today to process emotion correctly. And you should tell them to talk about things, you know, because he never got to talk. Like, if he sat down with his dad and was like, oh, Dad, I feel sad. He'd be like, we all do. Like, shut the fuck up. Like, yeah. Move on. Like,
we all do.
Yeah, he's like, we all do. That's why we invented beer. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, go outside, smoke your cigarettes, and then, you know, handle business. And then you die a bitter death at 50.
Yeah, because you've just buried it. You've buried it the entire time. I think Bill Burr has a bit about that where he's like, you have a heart attack at 50. Like, your granddad had a heart attack at 50 because he was never allowed to say, God, that puppy's so cute.
That's not wrong. You know, my grandfather did. My grandfather died on my 7th birthday.
Wow.
You know, I just got done opening presents and my mom answers the phone and be like, oh, shit. You know, and so, yeah, have that stigma on top of your birthday. No, it's fine. You know, you look at men and that's just how it was. You died of heart disease in your 60s. You had 15 kids. You worked on a farm. Like, that's where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And so you prune back those lessons. And you look back at your kids and say, okay, I'm not going to give them the negative things. Show them. But I don't want you to grow up with this stigma. And then ideally, they take that and they're smart enough to pass that on to their kids and their kids. And this is how you become better people. Ideally. And I go back to, like, that foundation that all the honor, integrity, and all the things that martial arts stacks up on. And my goal has been with the kids to make a real strong foundation so that whatever they stack on top of it in the future, it's not going to crumble. You know, it's not going to come falling down. It's struggling. How do I kind of water the plant that is myself?
Yeah.
You all do it. I do it with them.
Yeah.
I show them what I've gone through. I show them what I've not gone through. You know, I kind of, like, I keep ideas and then like, okay, well, I'm gonna have to talk to my kids about this at some point. But you cannot, and I learned this, I think, coming out of my last relationship, was like, you cannot compartmentalize things.
Yeah.
You can't say, this is my job, stay away from it. You can't say, these are my kids, I'm gonna wait to introduce you to them. Like, it's all very convoluted and messy, and it's all about, I think, how well you manage the mess more than anything else. Because you can't, if you compartmentalize things, this is my relationship, these are my kids, this is my job, like,
it almost becomes like a house of cards. You can focus a little bit more on each individual thing, but because it doesn't necessarily interact with the other things, it almost like it starves each thing of what it could have gotten from all the other things. Kind of loses like the humanity of the entire situation in a way, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's probably one of the things that destroyed the last relationship I was in. Yeah.
I think I'm curious, you know, we started this by talking a lot about, you know, the black belt, mm-hmm. and how it doesn't necessarily confer a, you know, sense of
being
of
a good human,
being a good human just by the process of getting it. So I'm curious, like, that's an observation that I think comes to terms, like a someone practicing jiu-jitsu comes to terms with over a handful of years. It's not necessarily something they realize immediately. Most of the time people walk in and they just kind of defer to, you know, whoever's instructing them, especially if they have a black belt, especially if they've been a black belt for a long time. And I'm curious if that understanding of like the title doesn't equate good person, mm-hmm. or the not good person, but necessarily all the best qualities, the perfect example.
Yeah.
Is that also something that is worth teaching your kids? That just you're the parent doesn't mean that you're
absolutely an ideal. Absolutely. I mean, obviously nobody's perfect, but I see it a lot. I think maybe because I'm kind of cynical, but I also have this confidence about me, outward facing, that I don't really care what people think of me very much. You know, I want people to like me, of course, and they like me on the merits of my jiu-jitsu, and they but like language, for example, I have the world's worst language. I am vulgar, and I've never hidden that from my kid. One of my friends was in the academy the other day, and he called his kid, and he was like, "Oh, you know, such and such, go ahead and collect your things." I'm like, I don't think I've ever said collect your things to my kids. I've always told them, "Hey, we have to leave right now. Get your shit together. Get your shoes on. Get in the car." Like, it's always been that way. It's always been like raw, yeah, in a way. And my kids look at like other parents, and they're like, "Oh, that kid's never been sworn at before." Like, you can tell that kid's never been called a fucking idiot. I say that all the time.
Some people would push on that and say something like, they would say part of parenting is not exposing your kids to, you know, foul language, not saying the
word
on them or like cussing at them or whatever. And yet, you know, in a way, what you're saying is, this isn't a necessary box to check to raise good kids and good human beings.
Oh, absolutely
and be
not.
A good human being.
No.
And you're almost exposing them in a way of saying like, this is veneer. This isn't as important as other people say it is.
Absolutely not. I think that, or I mean, wait, maybe absolutely. Yeah. I was worried, and I stick to language because, I talk a lot and probably tell, but it's my job to talk a lot. But, it's the way that we convey things. I used to work with an old World War II veteran. He was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. And he told me, I was a kid when I was working with him. And I think I read it someplace else later on too. I can't exactly accredit to the right person, but, he goes, there's a big difference in the military, between get your fucking rifle and get your rifle. When you have this sense of relaxation about it, you can be more vulgar. You can convey some, the way you convey it is just different. When you cut everything out and you make everything clean, it's an urgency at that point. So like today, not that I'm saying this is the right way to raise your kids, but today when I look at my child, when I look at my son who's been like mouthing off or having all this problem, I look at him and I say, get your shoes on. He stops what he's doing. He gets his shoes on. Whereas if I swear at him, get your goddamn shoes on, get fucking shoes on. Like, where are your shoes? Where are your, you know, he just laughs it off.
Right.
You know? And I was worried about him taking this vulgarity into his day-to-day life, especially since we sent him to like a Presbyterian like preschool.
Perfect place for a child like that.
One of the things I constantly say to my kid is, if you don't listen to me, Jesus is going to stop loving you. I say that all the time. And I'm just waiting for the first kid to push him around on the playground, and he's going to be like, Jesus is going to stop loving you. I've had zero problems. They know there's dad's language when he drives, and then there's the stuff I can say.
Okay.
And I think hiding something like that, it robs them of the ability to make a decision about what is right and wrong for them. Kids, there's another thing that people say all the time. Why would you let your kid do that? I don't let my kid do anything. My kid does things. He's his own individual. Especially as you watch them grow, you'll see your son's personality like come out.
Yeah.
Right now, he's just a blobfish.
Yeah, that's true. A very, very cute one.
And yes, he is a very cute blobfish. But he knows nothing other than to just eat.
Yeah, he stays places. When I put him down, I'm like, you'll be there when I come back.
Yeah.
And he is, because he can't move.
Yeah, that will change. You know, they have a sense of right and wrong, whether you've instilled it in them or not. And I think when you hide negative experiences from them, you kind of rob them of the opportunity to make a decision for themselves. So my way of looking at it is, I'm going to let him make a decision, and we'll work on it together at that point. He's going to go to school, and he's going to say some shit. Margot, my daughter, she's going to go to school, and she's going to make some decisions. When those decisions come back at me, then I can sit down and say, okay, well, this is a learning experience. This is why we did it this way. I try as often as I can to ask my kids what they think. Oftentimes, they're morons because they're children. But we talk about that, you know.
I just love that quote. I love that so much. Oftentimes they're morons because they're children.
They are. Like, they haven't had a chance to progress.
Sure.
I hope you don't get canceled for me calling people morons.
No, you're fine.
So
I'm uncancelable.
Uncancelable. Fantastic.
So are you.
Oh, no. No, we're not. Oh, I ever not. There's a line that I can cross, you know. But, yeah, the jiu-jitsu community can turn on you quickly
today. That is a good point.
But, yeah, you know, I don't know if I adopted this attitude because of the divorce, or this was my attitude that my dad and my mom give me. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe I'm just smarter than my parents, which is what I'm really hoping for, because,
you know, we want the generations to progress. That's yeah, really what it's all about.
So I hope I answered your question. I forgot what your question was.
No. I like it. Because we talked about all these different things that I think people listening to this or watching this or whatever, I wish I was in their shoes trying to picture what your interaction with your kids is like.
It's interesting.
It's interesting. It's different. It's very different. And I think that the fascinating part about that is that you're essentially paving this like road of raising your kids in a way that is a little bit different than what other people would expect, because your circumstances are different.
Mm-hmm.
Your style is different. Your way of talking to them is different. And yet the end result that you're going for isn't necessarily different than what other people want their kids. Like, you want your kids to have good character, have integrity, to mm-hmm. know the difference between right and wrong, to treat people with respect, to be able to go to a place and understand, here's a person of authority, here's my peers, here's how I interact with these different worlds. You're cavalier in your language, but you're not cavalier in your approach. It seems precise in a way of like, this is what I'm building.
Yeah, I think unfortunately, I can tie everything into jiu-jitsu.
Please.
And when I tell people, when I build people up to be able to defend themselves or to fight or to compete or something like that, I tell them, listen, for the first 4 or 5 years, I'm going to give you all the tools that I know. Here's all the things that I can, here's all the moves, here's all the techniques, here's all the concepts, here's everything I can give you. You're going to put all the stuff in your toolbox. But when you go to work, when you go to compete, when you go to fight, when you go to do something, it's up to you to pick the right tools out of the toolbox in order to use them. I'm not going to tell you how to win or how to defend yourself. I'm going to give you the tools in order to do it. And I think that's the way that I'm looking at my kids, because at a certain point, they just take off. They're on their own. That's my goal. My goal is to make myself redundant. I want them to, as they reach a certain point, want to reach out and see how dad's doing, not need dad. And that for sure is something that came from my own father, you know. That's the idea, you know, like I want to give them what you say is like you said things that are pretty general, a sense of right and wrong. What is right and wrong? Because that, depending on which side you're on,
right,
you know, both sides are almost always feel like they're right, sure. You know. And so I want my kids to have a concept when they get into a situation to go, okay, this is my sense of right and wrong, and what do I do from here? You know, I want them to make these decisions on their own, because I don't want them to have my own views on it.
Right. You don't want them to necessarily, you don't want them to be like copies of what you look at things. You want them to have their own autonomy and their own agency.
Absolutely.
In like how they make these decisions and deal with it. So how do you actually foster agency, autonomy with your kids? Cause I've seen you interact with your kids at the academy, and I've seen people like look sometimes when you're like, get back there, or like, you know, whatever. Like, what are you doing on the fucking, like, take your shoes off when you get on the fucking mats? Like, you know, and I'm curious, like, how do you actually go about, you know, or what ways have you found? Because maybe it's not proactive where you're like, I'm going to do this step-by-step plan. But like, what ways have you found that actually functions to develop agency autonomy in the kids?
Well, first of all, you often, and most people see me interact with my kids when I'm at work. So if you can imagine taking your kids to work and then being responsible for 30 people trying to learn how to kill each other at the same time, you'll see a very short version of me.
Yes.
Where I have too much resting on my shoulders to sit down and be like, hey, buddy, how do you feel about this? You know, it's like, no, you need to go do whatever you need to do and get the hell away from me, because I have this problem and yeah. I know you're not going to be hurt and I know they're not going to be hurt. And like, then I can do my job. So you see a very different side of me, because I have to take my kids to work every day. But mostly I think to answer the question is to give them opportunity and then let them fail. For example, I woke up at 4 a.m. the other day, and I came out and Oliver was on the couch watching Paw Patrol. Now it's 4 a.m.
Wow.
And I looked at him and I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, I wanted to watch Paw Patrol. And you know, and the first instinct was like get your ass to bed. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, we have a long day going ahead of us. Like, get your ass back in bed. And the other part of me was like, I could just let him sit here and watch Paw Patrol all day, and then he's gonna figure out at 2 o'clock why he's exhausted. You know, but you also have to balance, like, hey, look, he's not really gonna learn that just yet. He's just gonna fall asleep. So really, it comes up a little bit later on. I'm noticing I can do that more with Margot, where I can be like, look, if you want to eat Cap'n Crunch for breakfast, go for it. But you're going to feel crummy because you did it. So giving them the opportunity to make a lot of mistakes and then, you know, giving them responsibility, a sense of responsibility. You know, here's your homework packet. If you don't do it by Friday, you're going to be in trouble. And then I wait till like the very last minute when she hasn't done it, and I'm like, what are you going to tell your teacher now? You know, of course we'll get it done, but, you know, because I don't want you to grow up illiterate.
Right.
But so there's like a balance.
Lesson
there.
Learned. Yeah. Congratulations.
But there's smaller ones all the time. Like, I don't tell my kids how to dress.
Sure.
I tell my kids what the weather is. I say, hey, it's going to be cold today. If you want to leave the house without a jacket, you're going to freeze. I'm going to be cozy, and you're not getting my jacket. So it's like this responsibility to yourself on small things.
Sure.
And then you build on it.
Yeah, yeah. You don't start with like learn how to cross the road on your own, kid. You're three yeah. now. Like it doesn't work
exactly.
That way.
It doesn't work that way because yeah. Or here's a knife. Yeah. One end's sharp.
Yeah. There's you know. There's progression that has to occur, just like anybody else's progression. I have this. I've talked about this on a lot of the previous episodes. I have this idea that kids train you the same way that you train them. Right. You learn from them the way they learn from you. If I had to raise a toddler, going from no kid to a toddler, I would go crazy. There's no way I'd be able to match that.
You would do it.
I mean, I'd be able to handle it. I'd figure it out. But it would be significantly harder than having had that 2 years or 2.5 years of training from the kid of like how to speak to them, what their schedule's like, what they react to, how they learn. And, yeah. you know, it's almost like you learn on the job. So there's like the it's a two-way street is essentially what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And yeah, you do learn a lot from your kids.
You learn a ton from the kids, right? So
mostly that they're idiots.
So I love that. I love it. So
it's not their fault. It's not their fault.
I remember being a kid. I thought I was super smart, but I was not smart. No, you're a pain
in the
ass.
In fact, after this, you need to call your father and your mother and apologize for all the dumb shit you did for the first 15 years of your life. It's true. No. That's not their fault, though. You know?
No, it's not their fault. And you can, yeah, God love their, God rest their, God bless their souls. You know what I mean? Bless your heart.
Bless your heart.
So how have you changed as a person since having your kids and since having that process of like seeing them grow?
Oh, I've run out of empathy and compassion for other people because I use it all on my children. I have no idea. I have no idea how I've changed it. I mean, I couldn't put it. I've never been asked that question before, so it's hard to say. Yeah. You know, I think that I think I do have a better idea of maybe I'm phrasing that wrong. Existentially, I have a pressure to make someone who is contributing to society. Nobody wants to raise the serial killer on accident. You know, so in a way, because you look at, nobody wants to make, and I think actually Bill Burr talked about this, you're just making another in the way kid. You know, someone else who doesn't look at the light in traffic. Like, nobody wants to make that kid who's just in the way. So you have a different pressure on yourself to not be in the way. You know, you have to conduct yourself a little bit better because you know, like, oh, you know, there's going to be someone after me that's going to have to deal with these problems that society creates, or that you help society politically or otherwise create. So you have somebody who's going to live in a world that after you're gone. And so existentially speaking, maybe I have a little bit more responsibility to society to be like not such a shitty person, and to raise my kids not to be shitty, because like, hey, it doesn't end with me. You know, there's going to be an extension. Someone's going to be reflected.
Right.
You know, I'm going to project myself.
Your example will live on, like the actual,
whether
types
you like
of
it or not.
Yeah, the actual behaviors that you exhibit in front of your kids will live on through your kids, whether you plan on that or want that to be the case.
Absolutely. I take a different approach to raising the boy as raising the girl. Oliver, I can knock around. I can be very physical. He's a very physical kid, whether I like it or not. I don't know how many times I've whacked him in the back of the head, which is horribly wrong.
Yeah, it's in like none of the books.
It's in none of the books.
And it's the opposite is in all the books.
But his head is always right there at arm level. And when he's doing something wrong, you can flick him in the back of the head, and all of a sudden they're doing something right. No, but I'm much more physical with Oliver. I can grab him and rip him out of the car. I can throw him. He's capable of this. But I could
just
never...
to be clear, by the way, you're not physically abusing your children.
I am not physically.
I feel like somebody might listen to that and they're like, why are they both so cavalier about this?
Well, also my job.
Right.
You have to remember that my job is wrestling people around and holding them down and making them say
physicality.
Uncle.
So I think that's also another thing to understand is that like contextually, your understanding of physical space and how you interact physically with other objects and people
absolutely
is at another level, right? So like you when you're like, oh, I you know, I pull them out of the car or throw them around or whatever, That doesn't mean, you know, like drunken uncle comes home and like throws their kid. That's not what that means.
Yeah, my kids don't have marks. No. Yeah, don't call CPS on me. No, they're fine. I promise they're fine. You know, their mom is a certified reporter, someone who has to report everything like a teacher. Yeah, no, the kids are fine.
I have that. So even not to interrupt, but yeah, even me not being like, I'm that uncle to all of my nephews, mm-hmm. Even the nieces, every single one of them is like, we're going to wrestle. Every time they see me, like, let's wrestle right now. I'm like, I'm here for dinner. Give me a second. We'll wrestle after dinner. But like every single one of them understands like, oh, this is the uncle that we like wrestle with. Like,
yeah, you can grab him.
A physicality. And I also treat them a little bit more like, not necessarily, I'm not going to say I'm like careless with them, but I let them experience like getting turned around and getting tossed up and getting rolled around and putting a little bit of pressure on them and letting them put a little pressure on me and letting them kind of push me around and let them experience. Cause I don't think they necessarily get that in other places. Like they don't necessarily get that with their, you know, their parents. They don't necessarily get that at school. They don't all do jiu-jitsu, so they don't get that at an academy. Yeah. And I think that physicality is really important for them to experience. So, anyway, you were saying.
Well, my kids learned to crawl. They learned to walk. They learned everything on the jiu-jitsu mats. These kids were born into my job. They were born into my passion and their mom's passion. You know, their mom's a black belt as well. Very, very, you know, a very good one. So my kids learned physicality from me and just my job. They've watched me from day one do jiu-jitsu, throw people around. And so they have an understanding of personal space. They have a different understanding of being grabbed and pushed around and stuff like that. But anyway, how physical I am with my son, I'm very different physically with my daughter because I think that, number one, boys and girls are different. We tried very early on to be non-gender specific. All the gender-specific toys, this stuff didn't make a damn bit of difference. The kid's going to make a sword out of anything, and she is going to knit, and she's going to finger knit clothes for her dolls. That's just the way it is. They get that from somewhere. But I look at, you know, Margot and how physical I am with her. I mean, I have to set like really clear boundaries. Like the day someone grabs you, like, oh, for example, they're sitting on the couch and fighting. And she's like, get off of me, get off of me. And I tell her, I'm like, listen, you say get off of me once. The next time you say get off of me, it's followed with a strike. Like, I will, like, what am I supposed to, you know, because no, I don't know what else to do.
Right.
You
have to teach her. It's like an interaction with the outside world that she has to kind of come to terms with, which is you're responsible for your safety,
absolutely,
your privacy, your space, mm-hmm, your physicality is your responsibility.
Yeah. And Oliver has to learn as well that when he steps over that bound, that there's a negative reaction. There's repercussions for overstepping your bounds physically. And I'm like, you know, there's a time and a place to be physical. There's a time and a place to wrestle. There's a time and a place to play. There's a time and a place to fight. And so, like, I work very hard at teaching those so that they can carry that into their teen years, so that Oliver knows, you know, I don't get to fight outside of this right situation, you know, and she knows that, hey, look, if we're not playing, then keep your hands off me. I think learning jiu-jitsu is going to help them, too. There's two books out there that are wonderful for anyone to read. They are by... Christ. It's The Gift of Fear, and there's another one that he wrote later on. Gavin DeBecker wrote these books. And when I found out I was having a girl, I was renting out the academy to this company, which is an executive protection company. And they're the forefront people on the forefront scientists or whatever, the authority on assault. And the first one is The Gift of Fear, and it teaches you that fear is not a bad thing. It teaches you that you should listen to fear. And then there's the second one, which is Protecting the Gift, which I believe he wrote after he had kids. And it's all about letting your kids respond to fear and what a good tool that is. And also it goes into situations where kids have been kidnapped or attacked or assaulted. And most of the book is all positive. Everything ends positively. But there's also those situations that, right. like, you know, they never did find
it's
Timmy.
Like nightmare situations.
Nightmare yeah. situations. And so I took that to heart, and I really kind of focused on, like, okay, how do I protect my kids? How do I allow them to protect themselves? And so a lot of the philosophies you see with jujitsu and things like that, they do reflect well on parenting in that situation, because parenting is raw. Parenting isn't Leave It to Beaver. It's not the 50s anymore. It's not the 60s anymore. You know, I used to be able to go outside and play all on my own. Had to come home when streetlights come on. You know, you hear that story all the time. I take my kid to the park and I'm right there. You know, I can't stop myself from sitting on top of my kid, just because society and things have changed, you know, the places that we live.
I would have actually assumed it's the opposite for you. It's interesting to hear you say that, because I would have assumed, because you have this, you know, history of learning, you know, how to defend yourself, how to defend others, what your body is capable of doing, and that you've raised your kids in that context. They might not necessarily understand what they've absorbed from that, but they've absorbed something from that. Mm-hmm. I would have assumed that you would be a little bit more like laissez-faire with allowing them the space to be a little bit further away, allowing them to be, you know, because you have, you would ostensibly have more confidence of being able to deal with, you know, surprise situations. But well, it sounds like it's the opposite.
No, it's a process more than anything. Every time you go somewhere, every time you do something, you let them go a little bit further to what your gut comfort level is. But you always have to remember, like, hey, if I have to reel something back, I have to reel it back really fast. I've seen my kids get hurt. You know, my Oliver has had 2 ambulance rides, busted toes, busted fingers, things like that. But you give them enough room to hurt themselves, but not really get in too much trouble. And every year they get older, every year they figure things out, you give them more space. You let them get further away from you, a little bit further away from you, a little bit further away from you. But you always have to have this gut feeling of, okay, if I need to rewind this, I'll rewind it really fast. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I reel these kids in immediately? Actually kind of goes into the language thing, because
they understand what the tone of your voice sounds like when things are a little bit more serious and, like, need to be immediate.
100%. If I say, you need to get here right now, or, like, get over here, like, they'll come over. But if I say, like, come on, guys, you know, get your shit, like, get your shoes, where are you, you know, get over, they're gonna lollygag, you know.
So then on the other side of that equation, how do you get your kids to understand that you are allowing this freedom for them to, you know, make decisions and ascend, like, really, you're allowing freedom to fail, right? You want them to succeed, but they're going to learn a lot from making the wrong choice as well. But at the same time, you're kind of, like, curtailing the tail ends of what could possibly go wrong. You're not handing them a knife. You're not handing them, like, you know, a flamethrower. You're like, you know, do you want to play with X or Y? Do you want to go in this direction or that direction? And you understand what the consequences are. How do you get them to understand that it's okay to, like, come back and check in and see how things are going with, you know, their decision making with you? Or do you even want them to do that?
They don't know it. Okay. You don't know it. A lot of this is, like, accidental. I think a lot of it's actually kind of subconscious. You know, I don't really think about these things actively as I'm doing it.
Of course.
It just kind of happens. And you'll be really surprised at how often they come back and say, hey, I'm having trouble with this. You know, they get to a point where they fail and then they come back for help, or I can't do this. You know, how do I do this? It's a very, my son, you know, he's coming up on 4, so he's a little bit not advanced. He'll get frustrated with something and then he'll drop it. And I'll be constantly telling him, what good does that do you? He got mad at the Nintendo and he threw the Nintendo. I'm like, okay, what did this accomplish?
Right.
And then, like, the Nintendo sits there on the floor because he can't reach it. I'm like, it's busted now. Like, what do you, that's it. And they're not going to recognize it right away. I'm hopeful that by the time, like, they're 10 or 11, they're looking back at it and going, like, oh, okay, you know, it's like a subconscious thing. I never really thought that when I get frustrated and I throw something, it doesn't help my end result. I'm just more frustrated because I now broke it.
Yeah.
You know, you hope that it comes back later on, but I don't think there's an active process, like, an active thought. No one recognizes that they're doing it.
looking forward, right? So, you know, you have a 7-year-old and almost 7-year-old, almost 4-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
They're still very, very young.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of years of them under your house.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're very welcome. Where's the scotch? Bring yeah. We need more alcohol. There's a lot upcoming, right? Mm-hmm. There's going to be a ton of different things that you are going to have to learn. There's going to be a ton of different things that they're going to have to learn. How do you envision your philosophy as a dad changing in that time, right? Is there a core to like your philosophy as a father that you're like, I'm going to hold on to this. This is what makes me a dad. This is what I think dads have to be. And everything else can kind of shift and change around it. Or are you like, okay, I can change around as I need to based off of the different contexts of their lives, you know, when they're preteen, teenager, going to college, et cetera.
I think I take it a little bit more relaxed. I do, because I don't know. I know what my life was like at, you know, 13, 14, 15, and how, you know, miserable or wonderful it was. They're going to have a different environment. And so I can't really say like, oh, I'm going to keep hold of this one particular. I know for sure I can tell you for certain, I'm going to keep the same freedom open. Because without that freedom, they won't come talk to you when they're older. If they feel like they are pushed, I think if they feel like, you know, look, no, this is what you do. This is how life is going to be for you. You don't do this. You don't do that. You don't. If you keep them locked down, then they're not going to be comfortable coming back to talk to you. You know, my kid's not going to come back and talk about heartbreak or that. My kid's not going to come back with questions about their personalities or, you know, it. God forbid in the coming years, you know, sexualities or what they heard someone say or drugs or alcohol. They're not going to come back and talk to you if they feel restricted in or if they feel like you have a hard set idea about something. If you have a hard set idea about religion, you must be Catholic. You must be this. You must not be this or you must be agnostic. Then when they have a question about the reasoning of why or they have a nagging feeling that I kind of feel like I want to be this way, then they're not going to want to come talk to you because they know for sure you're always rigid.
Mm-hmm.
So the only kind of like pillar that I will not deviate from is allowing them to have the freedom to experiment and but with a safety net.
Sure.
And then as they get older, there's less and less and less of a safety net and more opportunity for them to cause major failures. But your first 26, 28 years of your life should be just fucking up.
Yeah.
Because you can't harm much. You can.
But generally speaking, 99% of the mistakes that you're making or failures are either going to personally affect you.
Yeah.
And usually not even that extreme.
Yeah. I mean, like there are probably more like 75. I don't know. But like, yeah, you want to keep a safety net underneath them. Like I'm having a bad relationship. Like, all right, well, guess what? That guy needs to go, and he needs to go not because I don't like him, but he needs to go because this is a major red flag, and I can tell you, hey, this is what happened in my life where you don't need to be around this person anymore, regardless of how you feel. And yeah, you're going to go through some heartache and heartbreak, and you're going to feel sad and dejected and rejected, but you're going to process that, and it's better to process it at 20 than I can tell you for sure. It's much better to process a bad relationship, a really bad relationship. It's so much better to process it at 20, 25 than it is to process it at 40. Because processing shit when you're older, like 38, 39, when you've gone through bad situations, way harder than when you're 20.
Yeah, you don't have the bandwidth.
Exactly.
You have an entire world and a life that you have to keep moving forward that you can't just like put on pause to figure your own shit out.
You can't, you know. So let them make all these mistakes, but then they can come back and talk to you about it. So don't be so rigid in your opinions, regardless if you think that the kid's doing something right or wrong, you know, regardless of your views on what their orientations should be, you know. And I'm not trying to say like, oh, you need to be ultra liberal and let my kid do whatever. But you can tell them, hey, look, I don't like this, but I don't like this because of this reason. And if you feel differently, we need to talk about it. And not forcing your beliefs on your kids as much. that's probably the only thing that I can hold on to. And then I just have to let life revolve around that and then hope to Christ I'm right. that's about it. You just got to really hope that you're doing it correctly. And you're messing it up. For sure, I'm messing things up. I'm sure that my kid's going to have some weird, like, twitch and, you know, some impending doom deep down inside, you know, every time he sees a kitchen towel. You know what? My kid reached up to grab a pot of boiling water once.
Oh, man.
And the only thing I had in my hand was a kitchen towel. And I cracked him with the kitchen towel. All right. So now he's got a welt on his ass. And every time I pick up a kitchen towel, he flinches a little bit. There's damage there. But I pose it to you. Which is worse? A welt on his ass.
Or dying from being covered in boiling water.
Or being scalded in boiling water because I was making macaroni and cheese. These are the type of decisions you make as like a single father.
Yeah.
Like,
and you had a split second to make that decision. Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, don't ever do that again. You'll crack, you know, and you're like, so probably when he's older, his significant other's going to buy a dish rag and he's going to be like, oh God, you know,
yeah.
Oh, my father, you know, but he is also going to have all of his skin intact. Right. So like,
you know, my dad, it's interesting becoming a father and sort of looking back at the relationship that I had with my dad, he's still around, obviously. Mm-hmm. But like, I mean, as a child, and thinking about, obviously, these are things that he and my mom had to think about as well, and things that decisions they had to make on how they raised me and my brothers. And, you know, my dad has this saying that he would use. Essentially, the idea is like, if you stop your kid from burning themselves, they're not going to know that fire burns.
Yeah.
And so there is this inside of that saying, he has another version of it, which is like, I can pick up this glass and tell you that if you drop it, it'll break. But until you drop it and break it, you're not going to believe me.
Yeah. Your brother said the same thing. Your brother's told me the story.
That saying, like, he'll literally just pick up a glass these days and I'll be like, I get it. Lesson learned. Great talking to you, Dad. I'll see you in a couple days. So, you know, like, that has been burned into my memory. And so much of that kind of we've almost like expanded an entire hour's worth of just like that saying. It's like,
yeah,
autonomy, you know, a opportunity to succeed and fail, an opportunity to learn from experiences, agency in your decision making, but safety net, whether they understand it or not, of this isn't going to go sideways. You're not going to flip your one wheel over and like end up, you know, killing your grandma on Brand Boulevard. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You're literally just playing around with your kids or other kids in like a sandbox, right?
Yeah. It's all about how you manage it. And that's the art. I think that's the true art to raising up your kids, because everybody's going to have these concepts. Everybody's going to have their own concepts, their own ideals. I'm just a lot more relaxed in them. And I am not afraid of my kids making major mistakes, because I know that any major mistake that they make, I can fix right now, and I can fix it with them. I don't believe this is a new, I don't know, maybe it is kind of a new philosophy in parenting. I think it probably is, and I think it's just a result of a more, I mean, I'm not gonna say like liberal society, but where I live in Southern California, if I look at my cousins and things who live in Wisconsin, or if you go to, obviously, more, I'm not trying to be like political or anything, but like, let's just say the true nature of conservatism is sticking to a hard set of rules.
There's traditionalism that comes along with that. There's like a boundary setting that comes along with that. Absolutely.
And I don't really care for most traditions. I don't really care for much attachment to objects. An heirloom is just something that nobody threw away yet. It doesn't serve any purpose. Like, well, that was your great grandfather's, like, you know, such and such. It's like, he's been dead for 15 years. Like, who cares now? You know, or whatever. Like, if it serves a purpose, then keep it. And you want to hang on to those memories? Awesome. Hang on to those memories. But does that tradition serve a purpose in creating a better human being for society today? Because the society your grandfather grew up in, society of today, are drastically different societies. So,
and they don't, if your granddad was around, or like, you know, you could ask your grandpa, or like, oh, how do I deal with my kids' screen time? They're not going to have, they would have no fucking no. concept. Like, can you imagine trying to, if you try to explain to a father in the 50s, like, they have a 3-year-old. They never see them because they're working all the time. Their wife is at home raising this kid. They're like the entire time. if you tried to explain to them that in 50 years, in 60 years, in 70 years, the conversation of, is my child spending too much time watching television or playing games on their own personal computer?
Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't have a concept of even being able to approach that. So, yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, no. Generations change, things change, and the things that are transmitted from one generation to the next, by definition, are, you know, things that are going to have to help that generation have their own next generation that transmits further and further on.
Yeah. There was a, back in my IT days, there, someone told me of this little story, and it's actually kind of cool to kind of wrap things up, and I can actually wrap parenting around all of this.
Cool.
It's all about how you make ham. So if I, I'll do my best to remember it completely without butchering it, but a new wife gets married, and the mother hands down the ham recipe for whatever, Thanksgiving or what have you. Because, okay, this is how you make ham. So she takes it and she looks at it, and the first thing is okay, you buy this ham and then you cut the ends off of it. And then you do the whole thing, you recipe, and then you put it in this dish, and then you put it in the oven. And then one day she's reading this recipe and she looks at it and goes, why the hell do I cut the ends off the ham? This doesn't make sense. Because now, you know, a little bit more, she's grown up a little bit more, you know, society's changed, it's not her, you know, it's like, and she goes to her mom, Mom, why the hell do we cut the ends off the ham? And she goes, oh, that's just what your grandma did. And so she looks at grandma, Grandma, why the hell do we cut the ends off the ham? She goes, well, when I wrote the recipe, the ham didn't fit in the pan, so I cut the ends off to make it fit, and then I put that in the recipe. And that's just something erroneous that's just been handed down from generation to generation to generation. And so we look at the way that we, the way that we teach, or the way that we raise our kids, or the concepts that we have to look at them again and reevaluate. Am I just cutting off the ends of the ham because someone else did it and that's what I think is right? Or am I creating my own individuality and my own concepts? And am I getting rid of things that I need? Or am I leaving things on just for tradition's sake? That's like the cool tool that you get to use. Like, you get to ask yourself, hey, I think this is right. But is it right because someone else told me it's right? Or is it right because I'm individually thinking yes or no? And then what do I want this kid to pass on to mm-hmm. to its kids? You know, so I think maybe, yeah, that's the concept, you know. That's how you make ham.
Yeah, you got to figure out what part of the instructions that you received were just cutting the ends off the ham and what part of it is actually sufficient and necessary to being a good person.
Yeah, so ask why all the time. Why am I like this?
And I look Dad, why am I like the way I am?
And I look at my kids all the time and go, what's wrong with you? Which I think is like the worst thing to say to your children. It's like, what's wrong with you? Because it's horrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's, I think that maybe that's, that wraps up my concepts, you know?
I love it, dude.
So what Thank else did you have? Do you have anything else?
No, I mean, the only other question that I would have asked is, did you have any other dads that you talked to while your kid, like when your
all
kids
the time.
Were born? Yeah. Do you have other dads that you like, you know?
I have a story, a short one.
Okay.
I had plenty of mentors in jiu-jitsu, and when I was having a daughter, I spoke to my uncle first, my uncle who passed away, and I was really close to him. And he goes, hey, I went through two daughters, and I survived. I guess he didn't. But anyway, he's fine.
None of us do.
And he goes, you'll be fine. And then I asked someone else, and I asked him, like, hey, how did your life change with jiu-jitsu or with all of your, you know, everything that was going on? And he looked at me and went, she had the baby, not me. And then I realized, oh, there's a cultural thing here. Like, we're going to have drastically different fatherhoods.
Oh, my God. She had the baby, not me.
She had the baby. I didn't. Ooh. And I was like, oh, yeah. Well, this was a different situation.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, cool. We'll have fun with
See,
that.
See, that's
you know?
Not the type of dad that I'm asking questions to, you know?
Well, no, he is a wonderful father.
I'm sure.
As far as I could tell. But just a very different patriarchal society, different culture. You know, different cultures are going to have different things. Like, you have a lot of, imagine how many Armenian dads would say
the exact same thing.
Or would look at you today and be like, why aren't you, you know, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, you should be doing this. You know, you shouldn't be doing that. So, yeah, cultural and generational changes are going to be the biggest challenges I think we may face. But other than that, You know, I just love talking to other people. I mean, they're mostly wrong, but I love talking to other people.
Yeah. No. Plus, you get exposed to a lot of different people. So I'm sure you had so many other people that you were talking to, like, in and out of the academy, that you're like, yeah, these are my kids. And then they would also have kids. So you'd almost, like, compare notes organically without it necessarily even being a thing.
For sure. For sure. And I think that I don't hide my poor habits in front of anybody. Like, everybody gets to see who I am. Like, this is it. Whether I'm doing well or whether I'm doing not, I have no problem with that. I'm not really afraid of it. And so it led to some really great conversations with people. And without a lot of fear of talking, people are comfortable talking about it.
Good. Well, so, Robert, thank you so much, man.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it.
Hopefully it didn't ramble too much there.
No, that was perfect. I enjoyed the conversation. I think people who watched and listened to this also enjoyed it.
Awesome possum. Thanks so much.
Do jujitsu.
It'll help with everything.